Hello. My name is... Oh, what is it again? Oh, let me think. I know this one. Give me a second. It's Rob Bennett. That's it. My name is Rob Bennett. I am the author of a book entitled Passion Saving. I know the name of that one. The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 30. I am recording it on Tuesday, October 21st, 2008. The PE10 level today is around 16. That's slightly on the high side, but a perfectly reasonable PE10 level. Stocks today offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this one is Fear and Greed and Hope and Love. I love to get the word love into my titles about investing topics, because that drives those passive investing enthusiasts crazy. You're not allowed to talk about love when you're analyzing stocks. Love has nothing to do with it. It's numbers. Numbers game, man. All right. The big thing at the PassionSaving.com site and in these podcasts is that Rob Bennett focuses on the emotional side of the investing project. That's the side no one likes to talk about. And it's important. A lot of people will say, oh, it's not, the reason we don't talk about it is it's not practical. It's not the hard stuff. It's not numbers. We don't need to talk about that sort of thing. That's fine if you've got some time to kill. But that's not the real arena. Well, I beg to differ. The stock investing is a combination of two very different things. Economic realities, which are controlled by human reason and which can generally be expressed in numbers, and human emotion, which is generally not expressed in numbers and which is highly unpredictable and highly, as a rule, highly unscientific. And for whatever reasons, most of the people who analyze stocks or tell us how to invest our money are numbers people. They're not terribly comfortable talking about emotions. And they ignore that. And they've gotten us into lots of trouble. They've gotten us into a big heap of trouble in the past 10, 20, 30 years by ignoring that. I estimate that human emotions are 70% of what influences your results in the long term as an investor. So 70% of the subject is pretty much ignored in the current literature, and lots and lots and lots and lots of mental energy is directed to examining the other 30%. And the result is that just about everything we've been told about investing is wrong. They get the numbers wrong. Because if you're told to solve a problem and you look at 30% of the problem and ignore 70%, you're going to get the answer wrong. No matter how determined or how intelligent you are working on that 30%, that the 70% you ignored is going to mess you up. And our key to understanding emotions, the emotional content present in the stock market at any given time, is valuations. That's the one way in which we see valuations reduced to a number. When you look at the PE10 number that applies to the stock market, which I announced at the beginning of this podcast, that's telling you how much emotional content there is in the stock price at any given time. Surprise, surprise, the conventional investing advice ignores valuations or downplays of valuations. You certainly will hear people say valuations matter. Not many people are quite willing to directly state that they think valuations don't matter. But when it comes time to doing their studies or doing their analysis, they leave it out. And when they leave it out, they get all the numbers we need to know about to develop our strategies wrong. When they give us advice for how to retire, the retirement advice is wrong. When they give us advice on how to set our stock allocation, the allocation advice is wrong. Because they ignored valuations, which is another way of saying they ignored human emotion. So Rob Bennett says. That's the Rob Bennett thesis that you'll hear about on these podcasts and that you'll read about at the website. But there is occasional acknowledgement that valuations is a factor. And the one place where you always hear emotion, human emotion, referenced in conventional descriptions of how stock investing works is in this phrase that I use as my tip off in the title of this podcast. They say that stock prices are influenced by fear and greed. We've all heard that. Fear and greed. Now, as a person who cares about the emotional side of stock investing, that very phrase rubs my fur the wrong way. You know, people reveal themselves in the words they use. And we are living in the dark ages of investing analysis when we don't look at how human emotions affect long-term investing returns. We are living in the dark ages. Our knowledge of this subject matter is primitive, pathetically primitive. And it comes through, in my opinion, it comes through in our use of this phrase, fear and greed. What they mean when they say stock prices are influenced by fear and greed is that when prices go up too high, when you have bull markets, they would maintain that greed is sending prices higher. People are grasping at ever higher returns, and they see other people getting high returns, and then they become greedy in turn, and prices go up, up, up. That's the idea being expressed. And then when prices start to go down, people become fearful, and prices go down, down, down. As is true of so much of the conventional / passive investing philosophy, this is a half-truth. Of course it's true that we have bull markets and we have bear markets, and that greed plays a role in bull markets, and fear plays a role in bear markets. But this phrase rubs me the wrong way in for two important reasons. It's a cartoon version of how emotions affect stock investing. It's cartoonish. It's It's embarrassing. It's so unadvanced, so unsophisticated, that it's I find it embarrassing. And it's so dark and negative. Fear and greed, are those the only emotions that investors hold? Are we monsters? Fear and greed are the only emotions we possess? How about hope? How about love? Do investors not feel these things? They do, and they do in my experience. I've talked with tens of thousands of middle-class investors on discussion boards during the first 6 years of the great safe withdrawal rate debate, and I've seen some fear and greed. I've also seen other negative emotions. I've seen shame and guilt. And I've seen positive emotions like hope and love. And we need to know about all of them. And we need to know about how they all apply. So this podcast is sort of an introduction to the investing emotions, but from what I hope is a little more sophisticated perspective than what you will usually hear listening to the conventional stock investing advice. Right off the bat, I will say that when I talk about that in the title of this podcast, I'm trying to balance the negative investing emotions, which are real, which do exist, with the positive investing emotions, which both the negative and positive emotions are overlooked by the conventional advisors, but the positive investing emotions aren't even mentioned. They don't even get a credit. So when I say fear and greed and hope and love, I'm trying to bring a little balance to this equation, that it's not just all fear and greed. Now, what that suggests is that I reject the traditional dichotomy that's talked about in investing. And the traditional dichotomy is bulls versus bears. Everybody's got to be a bull. They believe in stocks. We are to believe. And bears, they don't believe in stocks. We are to believe. How incredibly boring. I talked a little bit about the bull-bear dichotomy in an earlier podcast, and I'll probably need to return to it and to explore it in more depth. But it's stupid. It's a stupid dichotomy. I don't say that the people who came up with it are stupid or the people who cite it are stupid. I say that the idea is stupid. It's not about bulls versus bears. I won't go into it because it'll take too much time. But I don't like that dichotomy even a little bit. A much better dichotomy, a much better way of looking at what's going on in the stock market is reason versus emotions. And to contrast, when the stock market price is rational versus the times when it is emotional, you need a tool like the PE10 tool. There's an earlier podcast about that. PE10 rocks. The PE10 tool tells you when the stock market, when the price at least, is rational and when the price is irrational. And what you find is that the price is rational when it's at, say, 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 or 16 or 17. Those are the sorts of prices that exhibit emotional balance, that are rational. And the prices that are irrational are the ones above that, say 20 and above, and the ones below that, say below 12. Those are your irrational prices. And look what we've just done. We've thrown bullish prices, high prices, and bearish prices together. Bulls and bears aren't opposites. They're two sides of a single coin. They're emotional. Bulls and bears are emotional investors. The successful investor is a rational investor. The successful investor is an emotionally balanced investor. The successful investor is neither a bull nor a bear. The successful investor exhibits neither undue fear nor undue greed. The successful investor balances his feelings of fear and greed, which he cannot escape as a human. They're built in. He balances those negative emotions with positive emotions like hope and love. Lovers make better stock investors. I'm sorry, but it's true. It's true. I offer stock investing advice for swinging lovers. We need a Frank Sinatra song in the background. I used to like to quote Frank Sinatra songs back when I posted at the Vanguard Diehards board, and boy, did that make Mel Lindauer mad. I used to quote, I know my favorite one was All the Way. All the Way. When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you all the way. Through the good and lean years and through all the in-between years, come what may. That's buy and hold. That's buy and hold investing. That's true buy and hold. And I would, you know, you had to title your post at that board. You had to put a title on them, and I'd call it Frank Sinatra on effective asset allocation strategies. And Mel, bless his heart, would blow a gasket every time. All right. Greed. Is there a lot of greed in stock investing today? It might be a surprise for you to hear me say this, but I don't think so. We have been recently, we're not today, but we have been until a month or so ago at the highest stock valuation levels ever seen in the history of the U.S. market. The highest level in history until recently was a PE10 level of 33 that we reached in the month before the 1929 stock crash. And back in January of 2000, we went up to 44. We left that pathetic old 33 PE10 in the dust. We left that bad boy behind. So if you went by this cartoon approach to examining the emotions of investing, you might say, oh, investors were more greedy in the 1990s than they've ever been before. I'm sure there was some greed. Certainly there was. But in my conversations with middle-class investors, I don't see much evidence of greed. I'm sure that there's some. You see some bragging. Among the passive investing enthusiasts, there's bragging. There's this, you know, I did such and such. Who are you to tell me anything about stocks? What's the historical data matter to me? I made money. I'm this. I'm that. You definitely see that. But that's pride. That's not greed. Greed would be grasping for more. And the passive investing concept, for all its faults, is not a greedy approach to investing. Passive investors, and this is, of course, one of the reasons why I say I love John Bogle. John Bogle is a mixed bag. He's come up, some of his investing ideas, I think, are the best ideas out there, and some of his ideas are the worst ideas out there, and he's a package. You can't separate the good from the bad, and it worked during the 90s, and it's been a disaster from the year 2000 forward, but it is what it is. But it's not greedy. I don't think Bogle encourages greed. If you were, If you were looking for somebody that epitomizes greed, I suppose you might point to Jim Cramer. I mentioned him in a podcast the other day. I've never really seen, I don't know if it's Jim Cramer or James Cramer. I'm not sure how he goes. But I've never actually seen his program, so I probably shouldn't speak about it. And it doesn't interest me very much. I get the I've heard other people talk about him. I've seen a clip of him. I know what he looks like. I've seen a clip. I know his little, theatrical presentation he puts on. You could characterize that as greed if you wanted to. You know, he gives stock picks and he says it's going to go to the moon. And when prices are going down, he says sell everything. You could say that that's greed. I don't know. I don't know how much you should take it seriously. Is it just a comedy routine or is it serious? I get the impression it's sometimes serious and that people do buy and sell based on his recommendations, from what I understand. I don't spend much time. It's not something that interests me a great deal, so I don't spend much time on it. But you could argue that that's a greed approach, at least to some extent. But Bogle doesn't do any of that. He never gives stock picks. And he never recommends. He recommends sticking at the same stock allocation when prices are out of control. That's passive investing. But he doesn't recommend increasing your stock allocation when prices get out of control. Not at all. Not at all. If anything, he tilts things slightly the other way. He says he doesn't okay timing, which I do. I say you should lower your allocation when prices get out of control. That's timing the market. That's long-term timing. Bogle doesn't say you should engage in long-term timing, but he does say he has something he calls tactical asset allocation. And under tactical asset allocation, it's really timing. He comes up with this fancy phrase for it because he doesn't want to admit that he's contradicting himself when he recommends timing. But he says it's okay if prices get too high to lower your allocation a bit, which is exactly what you should be doing. But he sort of makes you feel ashamed of it. He sort of says, well, you should only do it a little bit, and you're fine if you don't do it. You're better if you don't do it, but if you must give in, he makes you feel bad about it. He makes you feel like it's something dirty when all you're doing is investing rationally. You're investing in a common sense way. So I don't at all agree with the way he presents it, but I don't think, in fairness, you can say that Bogle advocates greed. I don't think that would be right. And I don't think his followers do. Some of his followers, a little bit. Some of them, a little bit. But I don't see greed as being a big issue in stock investing today. I think the Bogle revolution, the indexing revolution, has taken the steam out of it. I think one of the reasons why Bogle is so popular is that he appeals to the middle class investor, not the sophisticated investor that might be drawn to somebody like Warren Buffett, who's going to study the balance sheets of all the companies. And the middle class investor is looking for simplicity, which Bogle provides, which I try to provide, and simplicity and realism. The middle-class investor, middle-class people are, I don't want to generalize, but middle-class people in general are pragmatic. And if you come across to them with, I'm going to make you a million overnight, that's a turnoff. To most, not to everyone. There are people that go for it, to be sure, but it's a turnoff. And Bogle is successful because he plays against that so successfully. And, I think that the appeal of passive investing is the get rich quick impulse. That's what makes us want to believe that we can get away with not lowering our stock allocation when prices get out of control. So if you want to call the get rich quick impulse greed, well, then there's some greed present in passive investing. There is. But it's not a rapacious greed. It's not. I don't at all get the feeling that most people are saying, I want more, more, more. I want it faster, faster, faster. What most people want is they want something simple that they don't have to spend a lot of time and energy studying. And they want something realistic. They want something they can believe in. And Bogle's ideas come across as very prudent. Stay the course sounds prudent. Buy and hold sounds like the sort of thing that would work in the real world. So I don't think that Bogle appeals to greed. And I think the reason he doesn't appeal to it is the middle class investor by nature is somewhat greedy, but not excessively so. Not excessively so. And so I don't see that as being so big a problem today. How about fear? Fear, I think, is a big one. I think fear is a much bigger problem than greed. And fear comes in all sorts of varieties and flavors. The conventional view is that we are only experiencing fear when we go to very low valuation levels. The idea there is fear is what makes the market drop to a P10 level of 8 after a huge bull market. People start to lose money and they become fearful and they won't touch stocks. They stay out of stocks. There's fear present, obviously. When we go to a P10 level of 8, there certainly is fear present. But I see fear being present in the 1990s. I think a big factor in that runaway bull market, the worst we have ever seen, was fear. I think a big factor is the middle class feels threatened. Middle class is, you know, it's different than being poor or being rich. If you're poor, that's bad. But it's, you know, if you're truly poor and you think of yourself as poor, there's almost a hopelessness to it. It's almost like, this is what I am. There are a lot of people who think of themselves as middle class who don't have much in the way of assets. But if you are striving, if you're on a career track and you're, you know, of some sort, and you're trying to move upward over time, you're seeking promotions, you're seeking raises, that defines you as middle class. And if you call yourself poor, you've more or less given up. You've given up the idea of a better life to come. That's how I think of it. I don't know if it's officially defined that way, but that's sort of how I would, when I hear the word poor, that's what I think of. Someone who's, you know, it could be someone who's just in bad straits, someone who has health problems or recently divorced or something, and they're struggling, and maybe they'll only be poor for a time, but there's a hopelessness contained in that, even if it's not a permanent hopelessness. There's a dark edge to the word poor that doesn't apply to the word middle class. And if you're rich, of course, money considerations become secondary. You're not really. You may care about money, but money is not going to make you or break you. But middle class, how I think of the word middle class, what I think of is striving. Middle class is always striving to move up. So there's always anxiety, because when you're striving, you can succeed or you can fail. If you succeed, there's obviously joy. So maybe I shouldn't say there's always anxiety, but as soon as you achieve that higher level, by definition, if you're middle class, you're striving for the next level. So the anxiety creeps back in. Whereas if you're rich, that might not be so. You might be rich and you might have a great accomplishment, and then you'll move to some other field and try to accomplish something in the other field. But there's no concern that if you happen to fail, you're going to come crashing to the ground. Whereas with the middle class, that's so. If you change careers, that's risky. If your company is bought out, there's risk. If your boss changes, there's risk. So I think, and we're going through changes in the economy in recent decades, rapid changes. There's always change, but the pace of change is more rapid. And a lot of middle class people are making very big salaries today. A lot of people at the upper end of the middle class are doing very, very well. But people at the lower end of the middle class are doing not so well. They're under pressures that they didn't necessarily feel in earlier days, where middle class had a stability to it that it doesn't have today. And so a lot of people at the lower middle class are anxious that they may fall out of the middle class altogether. And those at the upper end of the middle class are enjoying much more financial gains, but they also feel a lack of certainty about whether they're going to be able to continue to hold those gains. They could slip because the job market changes so quickly. The skill set that's needed for success in our industrialized economy changes so quickly. So I think that was a driver. I think fear about middle class status, and combined with our hyper-consumerism, which has been brought on by things like television and advanced marketing techniques, and the creation of so many wonderful products. That's a big part of consumerism. People always describe consumerism as, you know, all bad. You know, they talk about advertising, and I think advertising is a big contributor to consumerism. But part of it is just there's all these great things to buy. That's a positive way of looking at consumerism. And I think that's a big, big factor. People who, I don't want to go off on this riff, but people who buy things, people who spend all their money buying things are not dumb, in my opinion. They may have misplaced priorities. I think if you don't save anything, I would certainly say you have misplaced priorities. But maybe you haven't thought things through carefully enough. Maybe that would be the way to say it. But each spending decision probably makes a good bit of sense. A lot of the things that are available for sale in this consumer wonderland of ours are fantastic value propositions. Perhaps not in relative terms. They're not as good as saving, in my opinion. But people buy for good reason, and in many cases. But advertising and marketing does also contribute. But overall, the point here is, because of that, people don't save much, and so people are worried about their retirements. And you combine it with this middle-class instability where people are saying, I need more to retire than I did in the old, than my parents did, because my standard of living is so much higher. I'm used to vacations. They didn't go on vacations. I'm used to a big house. They had a house one half the size. I'm used to three cars. They only had one. I'm used to airline travel. They went everywhere by car. And if you're not, you know, if you have these higher aspirations for yourself and you don't have savings, that creates anxiety about how big your retirement account is. And that can drive a bull market. Every bit as much as greed can, or more so. Because what fear can do is, what I believe we need to do when we get into a bull market is we need to educate people that bull markets are bad. Bull markets are bad for middle-class investors. But you see those numbers going up, and you want to believe them. You say, when they tell you you have $100,000 in your portfolio, you want to believe that. And that's where rational investing gets into trouble. A rational investor comes along and tells you, oh, that's cotton candy. Only $50,000 of that is real. Well, if you're afraid about falling behind, you don't want to hear that message. So you block it out. You go into denial. And that's what a bull market is, denial of the realities. So I think fear is a much bigger driver of our past bull market than greed was, and may yet become a driver of a vicious bear market. I hope not, but that could happen. That could be in the future. How about shame? People don't talk about shame. They talk about fear and greed. I see a lot of shame in discussions, when I engage in discussions about the realities of stock investing with middle-class investors. I see a lot of shame among the investing experts. That's where I really see it. And they have shame. When you get into a bull market, there was a phrase I loved that John D. Craig used to use at the Vanguard Diehards board. We would talk about why all these slogans that are used by the passive investors are half-truths. Stocks for the long run, and stay the course and buy and hold, all this sort of thing. Timing doesn't work. All these things are half-truths. There's important truths being conveyed, but there's also important deceptions and self-deceptions being conveyed. And John D. Craig, that's a screen name, not a real name, he would describe this as white lies. But he said he thought the white lies were a good thing. He wasn't saying it critically. He says he was glad that the passive investing advocates engage in white lies. I don't think the white lies worked out well at all. I think he's right that a lot of it started out as white lies. The feeling was we need to market these ideas. And I'm sure they did market research to find out what people would buy, what would work. And they came up with some of these slogans. And, you know, timing doesn't work is a marketing slogan. Because it appeals to that side of the middle class, the pragmatic middle class person that says, hey, these guys are shooting straight. They're telling me right off timing doesn't work. They're not appealing to my greed. They're not insulting my intelligence. But of course, the reality is timing doesn't work is true about short-term timing. But it can also be used as a way to trick people into thinking it's not necessary to lower their stock allocation when prices get too high. So it's a two-edged sword. And some of these things are so obvious. These things started to get marketed. They started as white lies, and I think people didn't think they would hurt anyone. They just said, oh, it's justified. We have to keep the message simple. But then what happened is the message became so popular that prices went higher than anyone ever could have anticipated. And that meant the suffering that resulted from those quote-unquote white lies ended up being much, much, much bigger than anyone anticipated or intended. And, you know, the valuation levels went higher than anyone could have thought. And, you know, then you got into a situation where the experts should be coming forward and saying, look, we got this wrong. It's not really true. The timing doesn't work. You should be timing. You should be lowering your stock allocation. We're at a P10 level of 40. You know, are you insane? You know, you've got a 70% stock allocation. Get it down. Get down to 30 fast, man. But I think, I don't know to what extent the experts knew to say that. I think some did, at least to some extent, know that that needed to be said. But I think there was shame in admitting that they had caused the problem in the first place with all these marketing slogans that got carried away, that took us to places no one had originally expected or intended that they would take us. So there was shame. The mistakes that are made, you know, in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, the studies we use to plan our retirements, they're painfully obvious mistakes. Mistakes you wouldn't expect from a seventh grader. Mistakes in fundamental logic, you know, basic logic. They confuse. They find out what withdrawal rate survived in the past, and they call it the safe withdrawal rate, as if the fact that something had survived on two occasions could prove that it was safe. Shame is one of the reasons we are locked in to the passive investing school today, even though it's been discredited by the academic research dating back to the 1980s. We're stuck with this thing. I'm trying to push it off the table, you know, get the garbage man to come and take the dead carcass before the smell becomes overpowering, if it's not already. But shame holds us back. That's a big investing emotion, a big negative investing emotion. Guilt is another one. People don't. If we all invested in a capsule somewhere, if we all were just independent actors, I think we would come to accept the realities of investing much easier and much quicker, because the only people we would hurt by investing poorly would be ourselves. But that's not the way it works. A big theme that I come back to again and again is community. And investing is not a solitary activity. It is an activity engaged in by communities. What that means is, in 1996, you invest in stocks, you have great results for a year or two, and you start to tell all your friends about it. You go to parties, you tell them. You know, you're at work, you tell your friends. Then your friends, well, they believe you. They trust you in a way that they wouldn't trust somebody on television. You know, this is like multi-level marketing. Stocks are sold by multi-level marketing, and the people doing the marketing aren't even paid a commission. They just willingly, they tell their friends, I've made bundles. You're a fool not to get in on this. And they say, well, aren't prices sort of high? Oh no, passive investing. Have you heard of it? It's this wonderful thing. You don't have to worry about the price. You can invest in stocks at any price. You'll do fine. Take my word for it. It worked for me. I did fine. I thought prices were high in 95 when I got in. Look at me. I'm doing great. That's how stocks are sold. There's marketing, you know, there's marketing expenses to sell stocks. They put commercials on television. But the stuff that really sells them is when other investors, friends of yours, have good results to report. And that, of course, happens in bull markets. The worst time to put your money into stocks is at the top of a bull market. But that's when you're hearing the most marketing messages from your friends. That's when the selling of stocks is in overdrive. And that's when passive investing does its dark magic by telling us to ignore our common sense and to just hope that somehow it's all going to be different this time than it's ever been before. And we feel guilt. You see, the person who went in 95 and had good results for 2 or 3 years and then told all his friends, well, in 95 he was a skeptic himself. He wasn't sure if it was a good thing to put his money in stocks. Then he became convinced, and then he told his friends. He didn't tell his friends till he was quote-unquote sure. Now, his friends have had 8 years of poor returns, followed by a massive stock crash. Now he's having doubts. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe this passive investing isn't what it's cut out to be. But he's got guilt. I hurt my friends. I hurt my family. I hurt myself. He's got guilt. The guilt stops him from reversing what he got wrong. His guilt stops him from acknowledging his mistakes. That keeps these high prices, these damaging high prices in effect longer than they would otherwise remain in effect. Guilt really does two bad things. It keeps the high prices in effect longer because it stops us from acknowledging the harm we've done. And in order to move forward and become effective investors, we need to learn from our mistakes. We need to acknowledge what we got wrong. The guilt, the harm we've done to others, stops us from doing that. And then, when we finally do admit it, when the pain gets so great that we start to admit I was wrong about stocks, a different kind of guilt comes in that then drives prices. You know, once they start to fall, and we're sort of in the transition period now, but when they start to fall, when prices start to fall, there's sort of a half admission. But then that can cause more guilt to flood in, because then you sell your own stocks and then you start thinking about all the people you've hurt. And then that causes the whole stock thing to become this dark subject in your mind, something you don't want to talk about. You know, maybe when prices were high, you didn't want to talk about it because you didn't want to hear the realities. You didn't want to hear the negative realities about stocks. Now, when they're low, you don't want to hear the positive realities. You're just as unwilling to listen to the realities. But now the realities you're shutting out are that stocks, in many ways, are a wonderful asset class. See, that's why I say passive investing is both a bull and a bear thing. It's two sides of a single coin. It's emotional investing. That's what it is. And rational investing is assessing the value proposition. Rational investing is trying to get the probabilities on your side, the probabilities of long-term success. And rational investing is emotionally balanced. Rational investors appreciate both the good and the bad of all price movements, both upward and downward. But emotional/passive investors, they're controlled by these negative emotions. And one of them is guilt. And guilt can, just as fear can cause a bull market or a bear market, so can guilt. Guilt can cause, you know, you would think, looking at this intuitively, you would think when we were at those absurd price levels, say in 2000, when we were at a P10 level of 44, and I would say, we're going to have a stock crash. So people would say, well, why don't we have it? You're telling us we're going to have a stock crash, Rob. Why don't we have it? 2001, we didn't have a stock crash. 2002, we didn't have a stock crash. 2005, we still hadn't had a stock crash. 2007, we still hadn't had a stock crash. Guilt can stop prices from crashing because guilt can stop us from recognizing the realities. And stock prices crash only when we let those realities in. And now that we have crashed, in economic terms, it would be good if we didn't have further price drops. But guilt now can eat away at us and cause us just to become sick of stocks. And it doesn't have to happen in 3 months. It could happen in 5 years. But there could come a time when all the people who were saying stocks for the long run, timing is impossible, will end up saying no one should be invested in stocks ever. I'll never look at stocks again. And that's just another form of guilt. It's the same drive pushing things in a different direction. It's the dichotomy is between rational investing and emotional investing. And the same emotions that cause crazy high prices cause crazy low prices. It's the emotionalism that is the consistent theme of non-rational investing strategies. How about love? My favorite one. Love, love, love. I had a silly song when my boy was born, my first boy, Timothy, and I had some silly, I don't think I could even remember it today, but I used to have a silly song I'd sing of, Timothy, 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 love, love, love. There's something about growing up in the 60s that erodes a person's brain cells. And he becomes a love man. There was where was that song? I am the president of the United States of Love. Was that on Hair? I think that was on the Hair soundtrack, but I could be wrong. I always think of things like, I always think of the 60s when I hear the phrase love. I ask myself, you know, how did I get to be so smart? How did I know that the safe withdrawal rate studies were wrong? How did I know that valuations affect long-term returns? How did I know that you need to lower your stock allocation when prices go to la-la land? How did Rob Bennett get so smart? And the answer is, it had nothing to do with IQ points. It had to do with the fact that I was putting together a plan to hand in a resignation to a high-paying corporate job and to live the life of a freelance writer, which is much less stable financially and much less lucrative. And I had to get it right. Why did I have to get it right? Because I love my wife, and I love my two boys, and I love my writing. So I didn't want to jeopardize these things by messing up. So investing for me was not a game. It's not a video game where you're, you know, there's so much of this macho stuff among people who call themselves investing experts. You know, I have a bigger chart than you do. So I must be smarter. My advice must be better. That makes a big difference. I didn't want the thing to fail. I remember a guy, I don't know his screen name, but this was just before the beginning of the great safe withdrawal rate debate. The debate began in May of 2002. I think this might have been a couple months before, say February or March. That's my thought. Could have been January. But there was a guy on the Motley Fool board, and he was, you know, he put up a post and he said, stocks are making me nervous. I'm lowering my stock allocation. And this guy was just smeared every way from here to next week. You know, he was stupid. He was dumb. He was emotional. He was this. He was that. He didn't belong on a retire early board. He didn't know anything about investing. And they shut him up. They silenced him. They didn't want to hear that. When I say they, I don't mean the entire board. The board was wonderful. A small group. Passive investing enthusiast, my favorite target. That's who it was. You know, small group of people. Dogmatics. And I think about that guy. And it was one of the things that drove me to point out the errors in the old school studies. I had known that the studies were wrong, dating way back to the mid-90s. I wasn't sure, but I believed that they were wrong. And I had held back from posting about it for multiple reasons. I didn't like the idea of getting smeared myself, and I wasn't sure, and I wanted to build the community up. I was mostly concerned about building the community, and I didn't want to do anything that would cause friction. But when I saw people like that getting smeared, that was one of the things that made my conscience bother me to the point where I said, you have to stick your neck out here. You know, if you're not going to do it, who's going to do it? You have to protect your fellow community members. And the guy was right, of course. If you went back to where stock prices were at the time he said this, sometime in early 2002, and you tracked out where we are today in October of 2008, he's done better. He was doing the right thing. He wasn't stupid. He allowed himself to be intimidated, I think. He wrote me an email. He said, thanks. So maybe he wasn't so intimidated, but I think he was to some extent. And I think other community members certainly were. They're intimidated by these people that act like they know something and that act, you know, that bring in numbers to try to quote-unquote prove their case. But what's going on there, it's a contest between, well, pride. Pride is the driving negative emotion among the dogmatics. And love. You know, this guy, he can't point to numbers. You know, he didn't study it in depth. Most of us haven't. Most people have not studied investing in depth. So, but there was something inside him telling him that this was wrong. And I think it was, it's love. It's a love for, you know, his family or whatever it happens to be. And what I say is you have to listen to those feelings. Don't deny them. Don't say, oh, I can't put numbers on it, so I have to discard it. It's a good idea to put numbers on it. It's a good idea to get to a point where you can assign numbers to it. But don't discard those feelings. Don't clamp down on those feelings. Let them out. Explore them. And that's, of course, what I want to see happen at our boards. I want people like that. And I wish I knew the guy's name. I just don't remember. It was so long ago. But I want people like that contributing. I want to hear those stories. One of the things that is the potential for internet discussion boards to help us understand investing is just unlimited. because the big unknown in investing today is the emotional side of the investing project. And discussion boards are the perfect place to learn about it, because you see emotions. And you can explore them. You can question. And then you can see how emotions change with changes in prices. It all plays out before you. It's like a giant laboratory where you can study these things. And it was never available to us before. I think one of the reasons our understanding of how stock investing works is so primitive is that we haven't had such things available to us in the past. But now we do. Hurrah! So we need to look at what... We need to hear those stories. I love to hear stories of quote-unquote losers. People who lose money in stocks. The way it works is that you always hear about the winners, and half the time they're exaggerating what they've won. You know, they report their winners. They fail to even mention the losers. But the people who lose can teach us so much. We all learn from mistakes. But the people who lose are afraid to speak up because they'll be attacked. They'll be ridiculed. So they keep quiet. And I so much want to hear the stories of those people, because we can learn so much from them. Another one is John Walter Russell. Now, you know, he does the research that is behind the calculators at my website and in his website. His website is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. He does all this wonderful investing research that includes valuations, that factors in the human side of the investing story. But John wasn't handing in a resignation from a high-paying job. He was retired from his government career. So he didn't have the motivations I had. I think John, he loves his work. He loves doing these statistical studies. And I think he loves talking to people and helping people. He loves an intellectual challenge. You know, I've heard him say... he was worried when he retired, what am I going to do with my time? He didn't like the idea of sitting around doing nothing. And, you know, the month he retired was the month the great debate began. And he just picked up on it and ran with the ball. But see, that's love. That's not fear or greed. That's love. He loves his work. So he cares about getting the numbers right. So love is an important investing emotion. Hope. Hope is another one. I think about hope a lot. I don't know how much I can go into it, because even an hour for these podcasts isn't enough time sometimes for me. I have an article at my website in the Investing for Humans section, and it's called "What's Faith Got to Do with It?" And I love coming up with a title like that, because, oh, if people hate it when I stick love in the title of a podcast, or if people hate it when I title one of my posts at a board, Frank Sinatra on asset allocation strategies. You know, what do they think when I start talking about faith? Faith is an investing question? Yes! Faith is an investing question. Yes! I think about God a lot. I don't have any secrets to reveal to you. He hasn't spoken to me, but I know that some people don't believe in God, and, you know, I sometimes question how strong my belief is. I have a test that I apply to myself sometimes. I say that if you really believe in God, say you really believe in God, you're sure. Well, if you really believe in God and you believe He's given us some commandments, and if you follow the commandments, you'll go to heaven. You know, these are the basics. If you believe these things, anything that happens here on planet Earth is small potatoes. You know, you're going to go to heaven. That's going to, you know, that's worth a million times any troubles you go through here on Earth. So you shouldn't get annoyed when you're in a traffic jam, right? And I do, you know, I'm like everybody else. I get annoyed when I'm in a traffic jam. I get impatient. I'm like, when's it going to end? You know, when am I going to get out of this? And so I, you know, whenever I start thinking that my faith is acceptable, I look at that. I look at the traffic jam test and I say, yeah, how much faith do you really have? So, you know, I think faith is it's a tough one, but, I do believe in God, though. I mean, if I check out a box, you know, I'm going to check, yes, I believe. And I want to believe more. I guess that's really the point. I want to believe more. So I think about, you know, how can I explore this question either to cause me to give up faith altogether. If there is no God, I'd rather not believe. You know, I don't want to believe in something that doesn't exist. But if I'm going to believe, then I should believe more. I don't like this middle ground. This middle ground makes me uneasy. I think that's hope. You know, there's these three theological virtues, faith and hope and charity, and faith is very easy to understand. It's knowing the commandments and so forth. And charity is being good to your neighbor, you know, helping the poor and helping the sick and helping the imprisoned. But I could never understand for a long time what is hope, and I've come to believe that that's what hope is. Hope is, I mean, it's not just believing. It's not just believing in God's laws. It's really having trust that God is there for you in a personal sort of way. That's how I think of it, in any event. But in this article, I compared my quest to strengthen my faith with my quest to become an effective long-term buy and hold investor. And that's it. The parallel is very strong and very real. People talk about, everybody today says they're a buy and hold investor. This is the most popular thing there is. But when you talk, when you go to a discussion board and you try to talk about, okay, what's required to succeed at this? Well, there's lots of people that are very interested. I don't like to mischaracterize board communities. There are lots of people who are very interested. But the passive investing dogmatists, no way, no how. They've got it all figured out. They know what it is. Just sticking with that stock allocation, that same old stock allocation. That's buy and hold. And I don't think that works. Because when I go to boards today, I see lots of worry, lots of anxiety. And if they had it all figured out, this stock crash wouldn't even bother them. But they don't have it all figured out. They don't. They talk the buy and hold talk, but they don't know how to walk the buy and hold walk. Not yet. And the reason they don't know is because we haven't explored it. It's because there's all this defensiveness. But investing, when they talk about risk, the risk is losing your money. And what you're really doing, I mentioned in an earlier podcast, the money you invest isn't green pieces of paper. It's a slice of your life energy that you're putting at risk. Because you had to give up a certain number of hours of your time to an employer to earn that money. And now you're taking a chance on losing it. It's like losing your time, which is like losing your life, a piece of it. So when you see that, when you see a big chunk of your life decline by 50%, of course that scares you. Of course it causes panic. And what do you need to possess to get from the dark times to the good times when you will recover those losses? You need hope. Hope is what sees you through. So it's very similar. It's a similar mental endeavor to the endeavor that, you know, to believe in God. You're almost trying to see something that there's evidence for it. There's evidence for God. Some people will say not, but there is. But it's it's not all clear. You know, it's not in front of you at the time when you face a challenge in life. You can't touch God. And the same thing's true with buy and hold investing. You can say during a rough patch, you can say, oh, here's the historical data. P10 level of 8, no problem. We're going to go back up in a couple of years. We'll be back to 14. You'll get your money back. Sure. You can say that. But when you're at 8 and everybody around you is panicking and the media is telling you get out of stocks and the media and the experts are saying we were wrong, we thought stocks were good, now we know they're not, that's different. That takes hope. You know, I faced this when prices were high. A lot of people said, you know, I would say, well, prices are going to crash. They have to crash. I said the market can't function unless we get back to reasonable price levels, ultimately. People would say, how do you know? And I felt that I knew based on the research I had done. But you can't touch it. You know, I can't. Until the price crash happens, some people aren't going to believe it. They have to see it. You know, like doubting Thomas. They have to see Jesus and touch the wounds before they can believe in a price crash. Now we see it, and some don't believe it even after we've seen it. People are struggling. Some do. Some now say, oh, now I get it. Now I get it. Now I see. Valuations do matter. Others deny it to this day. These are questions of hope. They're questions of believing in the unseen. They're questions of faith and hope. Believing in the unseen. So these are the sort of questions that I think we need to explore in much more depth, and I'll be doing that in future podcasts and in articles at my site. But I hope that we're going to have a growing community discussing these issues. I hope that at some time, not too far in the future, the whole investing world will be discussing these questions. I think this is the future of investing. We've drilled down on the 30% of intellectual questions. We've done that to death. We've ignored 70% of the investing project, the emotions. We've ignored fear and greed and shame and guilt and hope and love and lots of other investing emotions. Lots of other emotions that have a play in the success we have with our investing strategies. I look forward to a day when we discuss those sorts of questions in much more depth, from all different sorts of angles, and at all different sorts of places. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.